Hello, you're listening to a special podcast of our extended interview with Armando Iannucci. This is an extended version of the interview which appeared in episode 142 of The Pod Delusion. To hear the full programme and listen to the rest of our archive, head over to poddelusion.co.uk. But now here's me talking to Armando. I started by asking him whether it was a surprise to get an OBE.
Well, it was a surprise. It feels like, in many ways, I think the only difference between not having it and having it is I feel a lot more like I've sold out. I feel like I'm much, much more a member of the establishment, which I've always wanted to be. I hate having to feel that I connect with my fans, and I think it's far better that I feel remote from, detached in a way, officially superior, if not actually metaphorically. So in many ways it's better. It's better that I'm an OBE than it's not. I've also found out that I can upgrade to a CBE using British Airways Avios points. So that's another plus.
And then your spat with Alistair Campbell did the rounds this week.
Twitter spat.
Yes.
Yes. Great phrase, Twitter spat.
Despite you comprehensively thrashing him over the course of two tweets.
Yes.
If I can dramatise it like that.
Yes. In less than 140 characters. Yeah. Yes. No. So 280 characters, I suppose. Yes.
Where on these points say that, did you have to think about accepting it for any of the sorts of things he was picking up on?
No, I mean, I got a letter completely out of the blue. And it's a very strange letter because you can't quite make out what it's saying. It says something like, it appears by the provenance of the Honours Committee your name has been recommended for recommendation for the for the function of officer of the, and if this is amenable to you, then it says if this is amenable to you, then you will hear nothing further from us until, and then it gives a date when all the names will be published. It's a very strange, and part of you just thinks, is this some kind of elaborate hoax? This is a wind up, isn't it? And yes, I mean, a part of me did think, oh no, I can't be getting involved in all this, but another part just thought, this would be really, really funny. And I've put my money on it being really, really funny.
are you going to be lording it over everyone? Make way?
No, because somebody told me, I met someone actually who had been to one of these services, who said, actually, you go there thinking, I've arrived. And then you realise actually you're surrounded by lots of people who actually do really deserve a lot of attention. You've spent, 40 years really doing very, very good work anonymously. And this is their big moment. So, no, I don't. I mean, the serious side of it is that, in a sort of garbled way, I think I said this before in an interview, is that I think, if you put your name in for awards like BAFTAs and Comedy Awards and so on, then that's the sort of area you're getting involved in. And I always think it's very nice to if you win or if you receive recognition, and if you do, you should say thank you very much, very politely and with grace, and then shut up. And that's fundamentally what I do. So I don't really see it as any, I don't want to diminish it in the eyes of all those who've also been so honoured. But I don't see it as any different from, any other type of, like getting an honorary degree, which I've, been very nice that I've received from some universities, and that's very nice, and I'm more than happy to say thank you to those that have said, but I then don't, it's not like I take my BAFTAs into work with me every day, and neither will I be using the letters OBE after my name, because I just feel that's a little bit rude and a bit ostentatious. So I won't be doing that, and it's fine. But I also don't, that thing that Alistair Campbell had of me, I don't know what it is, it's that description of me as being a kind of satirist out to tweak the tail of the establishment. I've never really seen myself as that. I see myself as someone who just makes funny things. And, Alan Partridge, I don't feel, is satire out to tweak the tail of the establishment. It just so happens, I suppose, that what I'm currently most well known for is the thick of it. But, I'm as equally interested in the merits of Partridge and the day-to-day and my Channel 4 shows and so on. It's just the body of work that, and my only real response to that is just think, what do I want to do next, and just think about that.
So I guess if you don't see yourself as this outsider, one thing I did want to ask was, with relation to the establishment.
Yes.
Your work has become so influential in political circles that, you know, you've had the Omni Shambles used in real life.
Yes.
Has this sort of crossover been strange for you?
It is strange, and it's slightly disturbing, because it's with all those things, you think, well, you know, it's always dangerous if you think, if you're writing comedy, that somehow it's going to change things, because it's not, and it's not going to change how people vote, or how they think, or how, you know, or how politicians are going to behave, or whatever. If you want to change things, then you should go into politics, not into comedy. But I do find it disturbing that the type of person portrayed in The Thick of It is also the type of person who in real life admires The Thick of It. That was the kind of worrying thing behind Alistair Campbell's criticism. He said, you know, Malcolm Tucker would not approve, and that he sided with Malcolm in the, you know, Malcolm takes on the establishment. And I was thinking, no, Malcolm Tucker is the embodiment of everything I disapprove of in British politics. He's the destructive, negative, calculating, media-obsessed bully who, in fact, has put a lot of people off politics. So I don't associate with Malcolm Tucker, but it does worry me that he's become a bit of a folk legend in the eyes of the political world.
I guess then moving on to talk about Veep, which is why I wanted to talk to you today. I mean, is there an interesting difference there in that? I mean, as far as I can tell from what I've seen of Veep so far, there isn't actually an analogous character to Malcolm Tucker in Veep, whereas there arguably is for some of the other characters from The Thick of It.
Oh, possibly. I mean, we certainly didn't want to do a translation of The Thick of It into American, because that would be very boring, it'd be very predictable, but also it just wouldn't work. Nicola Murray in The Thick of It is a very low-rung minister with not terribly much influence who can be bullied. But the vice president, although in reality she recognises she doesn't have much power and influence, is an office that is, you know, ingrained in the US Constitution. And if anyone like Malcolm came along and tried to bully her and swear at her, and whatever, he'd just be wrestled to the ground by five Secret Service men and taken outside and carted off somewhere. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. And that dynamic, therefore, doesn't in the office of the vice president, it just wouldn't exist. And it would be unrealistic to try and portray it as such. And I was far more interested in Veep in showing a different kind of dynamic at play. If anything, the person who has the Malcolm role is actually the opposite of Malcolm. It's a guy called Jonah who comes from the White House and basically has to tell her every week what the president wants her to say. And it's the message that she has to listen to. But the messenger himself is just this tall idiot with no charisma who clearly is bullied himself over at the White House and just comes over to the vice president's office for a bit of fun and his one moment in the sun, really.
What's the difference in political dynamic from moving from, you know, the Palace of Westminster and Parliament to the presidential system in Washington?
We're dealing with somebody who does have a bit more power and influence. I mean, the thing about America, love it or hate it, and argue over where it is in the world, it still has enormous influence, culturally as well as financially and politically. And therefore, you are on this huge public stage. Also, with someone like the vice president and the president, I mean, there's little things like, you know, if Nicola Murray went outside, you know, no one would notice. If Selina Meyer, the vice president in this, goes outside, she has 10 Secret Service guys and a motorcade of about 7 or 8 cars, and that's just the way it is. If she goes to a function, there's 200 or 300 people there who are all applauding her because they have to. That's the sort of the difference, and therefore you have to deal with that. But also, you know, everything she says is analysed. You know, it's a big deal if the vice president goes on a TV show and says something. It's a big deal if she's appearing somewhere. You know, obviously not as big a deal as if it's the president, and that's her to her eternal frustration. But you have to be aware of that. She has an enormous office, an enormous staff. You know, in reality, Joe Biden has a staff of at least 100, if not 150 to 200, has his own chief of staff and his own mini subset of people who have the same jobs, equivalent jobs in the White House. But there is also the fact that no matter how experienced and knowledgeable and what kind of influence she may have had in a previous existence in the Senate, suddenly she's the servant of the president. You know, she has to do what he tells her to do. Any power and responsibility she has, and it can be considerable, is there really at the whim of the president? So it could just disappear overnight. But also, overnight, you know, circumstances could change and she could become president. She could become the most powerful person on the planet. So there's that strange tightrope that she's walking.
Is it more challenging to write for American origins in a sense that, A, because you're British, I mean, I assume you're still doing tons and tons of research for this.
Yeah.
I mean, what did that entail? And given that America's political climate is so different to ours, it seems more polarised and simply mad. I mean, how do you write political comedy in a country where Herman Cain was a credible contender at once?
Well, it writes itself. No. I don't know, I've been a geek about American politics for a long time, so I kind of, I'm familiar with the ins and outs of how the whole system works. I then did lots of research out there, but I think it was more researching the type of person who inhabited DC rather than what they did, that was useful for. And then in the end, we just wrote what we thought was funny, and we didn't think about, oh, will they get this, will they get that? You know, that was there for HBO to tell us. Whether this was clear, but we also had, within Washington, we had three people attached to the show who were like consultants on the accuracy. So they would say, well, in DC, we would call it this. This wouldn't happen in Washington. You know, there'd be another guy who's called this who would do that. And so, but fundamentally, you know, all boils down to stuff that we're all familiar with. It's a sort of glorified office politics, really, or glorified, in the case of the vice president, existential nightmare that she goes through in trying to work out what she's for.
I imagine this gets asked every interview you do about it, but I mean, did the shadow of the West Wing loom over the production at all?
Well, in a slightly benign way. I mean, I was a big fan of the West Wing, but that stopped when? About 10 years ago. And when you watch it back now, you realise how aspirational it was. I mean, they were all great at their job and had the noblest of intentions, and somehow politics in America has become so polarized now, I'm not sure that positive outlook would wash. Actually, it's almost like the climate was there for a quite a dysfunctional comedic take on the American political system.
Is that an interesting contrast? I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into your work here, but an ongoing thread through a lot of your work seems to be, I don't know how to put this in a sort of elegant way, but everyone's a little bit hopeless in a sense, or everyone's not quite, in a sense that you
know, everyone's scared of being found out.
That's what I'm guessing at. I mean,
yeah, just everyone's sure that they're really fucking up, but nobody seems to have noticed. One or two people might have noticed, but if you get them on side, they might shut up.
So, is translating that worldview to America, where the whole sort of the thing is the American dream and the national identity is sort of formed around this sort of more positive outlook.
Yes.
Do you think Americans are they buying into?
I mean, I'm waging, and obviously, don't forget, we're doing this for HBO initially, who are, you know, the makers of The Sopranos and Curb Your Enthusiasm and all that, who, you know, are a very different observations of the American dream. So I think there's a lots of experience of knowing that their audience don't necessarily buy into the gift wrapped version of the American dream. And I think, you know, my gamble is that actually there's a high percentage of, you know, not just the American audience but the international audience who can see the fallacy behind that anyway.
I guess to sort of wrap things up, because it's been going on for quite a time now, I want to give you a chance to get away. As the thick of it's been following sort of real politics, not as a direct satire, but sort of follow the contours of the thing. Is Veep going to do the same thing? Are we going to see if Romney wins, is there going to be a new vice president in series two?
No, I mean, we've positioned Selena carefully, very centrally politically, so that you could conceive of her as an Obama vice president as well as a Romney vice president. She's very much in the middle. She could be a liberal Republican as well as a conservative Democrat. We did that knowing that there was an election due this year and things could change. And what I didn't want to do is make her one particular party and then find that party in reality is not in power, and therefore she's in a strange parallel world that doesn't quite seem so believable. So we've been very careful to position her carefully in the centre at the moment.
Mm.
And then it's interesting when you dig out the old the first series of Yes Minister, Jim Hacker, who you think of as being a sort of right wing kind of Thatcherite minister, in the first series, which was written while James Callaghan was still in power, he's actually a left winger, and he has a trade unionist who's an advisor who's wearing a donkey jacket. I mean, it's bizarre. It's really strange. But because that his party is never mentioned, they were able in the second series to just subtly shove it a bit further over to the right so that it just chimed with who was actually in power.
I've got one slightly contentious question I had.
Okay, go on.
Beeps now, it's been out in America, it's been wildly successful. A few years ago, there was a Thick of It pilot made for ABC, which wasn't so successful. Yeah. I mean, what was the difference between that? Was that just...
Oh, loads of things. I mean, I was surprised by how I was welcomed over to America at the start of that, and then just kept waiting at a hotel, just thinking, oh, am I not involved? And finally, I wasn't really involved, and in the end, I just came home. Because I was so not involved in that. But also it was interesting watching, you know, it was with ABC, who are owned by Disney. So the idea of a Disney channel making The Thick of It is not, it's just not going to work. You know, so all those elements of The Thick of It, the people, I think, say, make The Thick of It what it is, like the language, the style, the shooting, the improvisations, they were all taken out of it. So it was this very conventionally short, conventionally acted sitcom. It wasn't terrible, it was just dull because it didn't have that edge to it. And so my lesson there was actually never think that because they're American they know what they're doing. And also, which is I think a mistake a lot of people make, you know, I think people all around the world think, hey, they're American, they therefore must be in charge and know what they're doing, you know. No, they can be idiots like us. And the other thing was, if ever I'm doing something like that, make sure I'm, you know, have final say and control over it. And therefore, the route via HBO has been absolutely wonderful in that regard. And I've really enjoyed it.
So have they not been sending down notes from executives or anything? I suppose it's because famous not
doing that. No, they're not. They're very, you know, and actually, whenever they've had notes, I found them very helpful and intelligent and indicative of the amount of experience they've had. I mean, you realise you're dealing with people who are at the top of their game and, you know how, you know, have had a track record in making shows that have worked. If ever we've had, I wouldn't even say it was a difference of opinion. I don't think we've had a clash or anything. But if ever we've reached a point where they were suggesting one thing and I was thinking that wouldn't work and whatever, in the end they would say, look, it's your show. It's your show. And they would lead me to it.
Excellent. And we'll put links to find out more about your show on the Pod Delusion website, Armando Annucci. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this extended interview. It's an extended version of an interview from episode 142 of The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, or from a sceptical rationalist point of view. To find out more about The Pod Delusion, head over to poddelusion.co.uk. And if you do enjoy what you've just heard, then why not head over to our website and make a donation, so we can keep doing what we do. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.